Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Singer-songwriter Billy Bragg has dedicated his 35-year-plus career to music and political activism. From his early punk-inspired records to his collaboration with the band Wilco on an album of lyrics written by American folk singer Woody Guthrie, Bragg's music, with a social and political consciousness, has earned him the nickname the People's Poet. Billy Bragg has also written 5 books that deal with music history and politics. He joins us now in our studio to talk about his new book, The 3 Dimensions of Freedom, and he agreed to perform a few acoustic songs. And tonight at 6:30, Billy Bragg will be at Columbia University in conversation with Mila Atmos. Billy, welcome to All of It.
Great to be here for All of It.
I love your Instagram blurb explanation of yourself.
As a progressive.
A progressive is someone who wants to see society reorganize so that everyone has access to the means by which to reach their full potential. Why did you decide to put that on Instagram?
Well, I think we live in a kind of post-ideological world where terms such as socialist come with a lot of baggage, you know, mostly from the 20th century, from terrible things that happened in what were really totalitarian states rather than socialist states. So to go straight in with the S word, people are already going to have some idea of you. I think a progressive, that definition of progressive is much wider, so that people who are broadly speaking on the same side as me don't have to define themselves in reference to an ideology that has many different flavors. I mean, you know, there's not just one type of socialism. There's lots of different types of socialism. Some of them have been negative in the past. The same as with patriotism. There are negative and positive types of patriotism. And I think we just need to be talking in a post-ideological world. We need to be talking in broader terms so that we can be more inclusive.
I know that you're really interested in talking about politics and activism with nuance. You have a real sense that nuance has been lost.
Totally.
What's an example of something that you care deeply about where you think the nuance has been lost? And then provide us a bit of the nuance.
Well, your listeners may not be surprised to hear that it's Brexit. At home, the debate is totally polarized between the people who want to leave with no deal whatsoever, which nobody voted for. I mean, it would be absolute chaos. Nobody voted for this during the referendum. And then on the other side, now the Liberal Democrats are now saying they would revoke the process by which we're leaving. So they would actually stop Brexit without having another referendum, without even giving the public the opportunity to discuss that issue. Although I don't want Brexit to happen, I happen to think that's quite an extreme view.
What about all those people voted?
Exactly, yeah, exactly. People voted. Whether we like it or not, people voted, and only another referendum can undo that. So we had European elections in July, and those two viewpoints won the most votes. The Labour Party, which has a more considered position, which is if they're elected, they will go to Europe, get a better deal, and then have a referendum with that deal versus Remain. So both... everybody's choices will be there. They got 14%. They were murdered. They normally get, in the Europeans, they'd get, you know, high 20s. And the terrible irony of this is that if we are to be saved from leaving the European Union, it will be the nuance that saves us. It will be the nuance of the Good Friday Peace Accord that brought the end to the violence in Northern Ireland. It'll be the nuance of the border in Ireland, how that remains open. It will be the nuance of our economic relationship with the other 27 nations. It'll be the nuance of the rights of the 3.1 million EU citizens who live and work and have families in the United Kingdom. These details are absolutely at the core of the debate around Brexit. Yet both the hardcore Remainers and our Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, don't want to talk about that. And that is why he suspended Parliament. Because if you actually get down and start looking at the detail that would be necessary to get a deal that is the fairest deal we could get, that doesn't destroy our trade too much, then there's a lot of nuance in that. In fact, the reason why we didn't leave in March, which was our original date, was because the hardcore leavers were not willing to pay the price of compromise that was in the original agreement, that the withdrawal agreement that Theresa May got. And that's the problem. Nobody on the Brexit side is willing to pay the price of Brexit. They'd rather just bust out and see what happens. So it's incredibly frustrating because so many people's livelihoods, their health, I mean, you know, people who need insulin and these kind of things, that's a crucial time aspect to getting that stuff in the country from Europe. And, you know, these people's lives are going to be on the line. You can't just blithely wave your hand and say, oh, it's going to be better, I promise you, you know. So we are stuck in a situation where polarization is the current situation, and Jeremy Corbyn, who hitherto has been dismissed as a radical and a communist, he's now the moderate. He's the guy, the Labour Party, mm-hmm. are the ones who are trying to bring Leave and Remain together to get a fair deal and to for leavers, but also to offer the Remainers a chance to vote again. He's the one, and they're spitting nails at him because he's sitting on the fence, in inverted commas. You know, he's, I mean, it's an odd time when moderate becomes a pejorative term, but that's where we are at the moment.
Yeah, it's interesting. People don't believe there's such a thing as a passionate middle anymore.
No.
Somehow, if you're in the middle, you've...
But Corbyn isn't, that's the weird thing. Corbyn isn't in the middle. He's on the radical left, but the debate is so out of whack from where it normally would be. He, in terms of where we are at the moment in the debate, he's the one who's offering the compromise. Yeah. And it annoys the Remainers so much. I mean, you know, there's a danger when the election comes, and this will have to be resolved with an election probably before Christmas, that people won't vote for the Labour Party because Jeremy Corbyn isn't 100% in favour of Remain. But if we're going to have another referendum, there has to be a viable Leave option, democratically, surely. Mm-hmm. We can't just say, oh, we're just going to have another referendum because we know we're going to win because the deal's so bad. The people who want to leave the European Union have got to be offered a viable option for Leave, a model for Leave that shows them what it would be like, because that image was never evoked during the original referendum campaign. But I have to say, I'm not a fan of referendums, of policy by plebiscite. It was the most divisive mm-hmm. day in Britain's post-war history, in my lifetime, the 23rd of June 2016. And the idea we're going to have another one, but and if your listeners are interested, they're probably already tired of this already, but if they are interested, the poll numbers are... The original result was 52 in favour of Leave, 48 Remain. The poll numbers are currently 52 Remain, 48 Leave. So
I have to admit, that morning when I got up early and I looked at my phone, I rubbed my eyes. I thought I had read it wrong. I thought I read the alert wrong.
I was at Glastonbury Festival.
Oh, really?
How weird is that? And at Glastonbury Festival, because it's right out in the sticks, you can't get a Wi-Fi signal. So I took a radio because I wanted to know. And I woke up, me and my partner... switched on the radio, and it was David Cameron speaking. I hadn't heard the result. And as he was speaking, I said to my partner, we've lost. I can't believe it. Listen, we've lost. And then I said to her, he's going to resign. He's going to resign. We hadn't even got out of bed, and we'd lost the referendum, and the Prime Minister resigned. It was like, and that night I did a gig at the Left Field. I run a field there, you know, for sort of a progressive politics and young bands, and I did a gig that night, and it was like triage for people. We were all of us, myself included, trying to make sense of it. It was one of those weird nights where you go on stage some nights and the audience make the noise they're supposed to make when you come off stage, when you go on stage, and you know something's in this audience and you're going to have to try and ride it. That happened to me the night Margaret Thatcher resigned. That was the first time it ever happened to me. Mm. And it happened that night. People were really riled up about what happened, and so that was people still stopped me in the street who were at that gig and mention it, and it was tough dealing with all that stuff at Glastonbury.
I bet for a lot of people, though, I bet they were glad they were there.
Yeah, kind of.
It's one of those nights when something happens that you want
to
be in community.
You need to be somewhere. Yeah, yeah.
You need to be focused on something. You need to be able to enjoy something else, but at the same time, turn to somebody and say,
connect with something.
Can you believe what just happened?
Yeah. And it's my great privilege to have been in Belfast, playing a show in Belfast the night Thatcher resigned. So you can imagine how they felt. They literally were dancing in the streets. And friends of mine in England were saying, I wish there was somewhere where we could have partied. I was like, you should have been in Belfast, mate. It was like incredible.
My guest is Billy Bragg. The name of his new book is The Three Dimensions of Freedom. So this is your fifth book. When did you decide to start writing books?
Well,
about
wrote,
the things that wrote, kind of yeah, are the, interesting to you.
I wrote my first book in 2006 after a racist fascist party called the British National Party won 12 seats on the local council of the town where I grew up in East London, where my family lived, Barking and Dagenham Council. And this was a real shock. I'd already made an album addressing that issue, an album called England Half English, that was trying to alert people to the rise of the far racist right. This had happened, and I just felt I had to do something more than write a song. So I wrote a book about belonging. I think belonging is more important than nationality or patriotism, the sense of belonging that really, if I don't know if you have a concept of Americanness, but in England they talk about Englishness. It's a vague concept, but if it means anything, it's got to mean, I think, about where you are rather than where you're from or where your grandparents were from, you know? It's got to be about place and the space that we share. So I wanted to write a book that expressed my love of the place that I came from and my family's, how I ended up being born there, those kind of things. So it was really an exploration of British identity, but also my hometown, what it was like growing up there, how my ancestors came there, you know, the economic circumstances that brought my ancestors together there. Things that, you know, I think everybody should know. I personally think, maybe I'm strange, but I think everyone should know why they were born, where they were born. Or should have some understanding of the...
What do you think that would provide somebody? What does that give somebody that you think is useful personally and also for community?
I think I think it gives them appreciation of the struggles that their ancestors went through and the pressures that they were under. And community-wise, I think it does give a sense of belonging. No one chooses to be born where they were born. It's one of those things we'll have to come to terms with. Some people reject it. Some people run away from it. Some people do all those things and then find they miss it terribly. It's a really important aspect of your personality, whether you embrace it or whether you reject it. And so I don't know if it's true in the United States of America, but in the UK, on search engines on the internet, family tree history comes second after pornography in search engines. So clearly it's important to some people.
That's so interesting.
Isn't it? Yeah, it is. And have programs like Who Do You Think You Are? They're compelling, aren't they?
They are. I actually worked on a program like that.
Yeah, they're compelling programs. And I think they reflect, because so many of us live in the moment. And, you know, our ancestors too lived in the moment. But, you know, how do we connect with them? And how do we learn from them? And how do we do justice to the sacrifices they made to get us where we are? We owe them a great deal. They're not around, most of them, not around to benefit from that. But by knowing them, it gives us a chance to get our bearings. You know, if someone gives you a map, it's just a piece of paper if you don't know where you are. The first thing you've got to know is where you are. And I think that those aspects of your personality are some vectors that at least give you a starting place to then map where it is you want to go. Without that, I think you're always going to be, you know, somewhere, you know, not knowing where you're between and maybe you know where you're going, but not where you're from.
Well, you find that with a lot of African American people, they want to know where I'm from someplace.
Yeah.
Where in Africa are my people from? They are enslaved people taken from a place to another place.
Of course.
And that I know for a lot of people that's really important.
Understandably.
Yeah.
I visited the Museum of African American History and Culture last week when I was in Washington, D.C. I only managed to go through the history part of it, but very, very powerful. Very, very powerful. And a reminder of my nation's role in the slave trade. You know, the exploitation of human beings, the sugar trade back to London, stuff back to Africa, more human beings. You know, our empire was built on such terrible, terrible misery.
My guest is Billy Bragg. I'm curious, you said something interesting. You said, I wanted to say more than I could say in a song, so I wrote a book.
Mm.
But you can say so much in a song.
Yeah, that's true. But you've got to... you've got to expand on ideas. But when you write a song, you're giving someone an idea to do with whatever they like with it. You know, when Smokey Robinson wrote the tracks of My Tears, he didn't know it was going to be about me and Teresa Sapsworth, who I sat across the aisle from when I was in the third year at school. He didn't realise that was going to be exactly about how I felt about her. Mm-hmm. He had no cognizance of that. So when you write a song, you let it go. If you're trying to go beyond that, if you're trying to use your platform in a way that actually does something more than just, give people a moment of inspiration, if you're trying to broaden and pick up on ideas and join the debate, then you need to write a little bit more, I think. So it was important to me to both to write the book about belonging and also to write the new book about accountability. I have written songs about these things. That's the thing. I have actually written these songs, and they only go so far. You know, you have to come back and come around again and build up the argument and give people the tools to make arguments themselves.
This is a 12-inch remix of yours.
I think it may be a triple album with a gatefold sleeve that builds up to a three-dimensional argument.
I'm still going to ask you to play a song, though.
Yeah, that's cool.
What's your first one you're going to play for
us? I think I might play a song that's, broadly speaking, is about accountability, which is called Not Everything That Counts Can Be Counted. Its first line comes from something that our Prime Minister once said when he was the Mayor of London, Boris Johnson. And they asked him about his politics, and he said, I am pro-having my cake and pro-eating it. And although that's a glib line, it underscores something really frightening, because it shows that Johnson and men like him have always got away with both writing the rules and breaking them at the same time. And that, I think, is the dangerous situation we find ourselves in, both in the UK at the moment and in this country, which we will doubtless touch upon after I've played this song. Nice if we could have our cake and eat it, but that's impossible to do. Too many people have invested in this outcome, they simply can't afford for it not to come true. We've ceded too much power to the market, let it decide what's right or wrong. Now everybody seems willing to lend credence, and truth is so devalued, it's going for a song. Not everything that counts can be counted, who holds the market to account? Not everything that counts can be counted, not everything that can be counted counts. People have had enough of experts and their inconvenient facts. Here's what the media really won't tell ya, exactly who it is taking control back. All opinions are equal in the free market of ideas, and truth is nothing more than opinion that's garnered the most likes, provoked the loudest cheers. Not everything that counts can be counted, who holds the markets to account? Not everything that counts can be counted, not everything that can be counted counts. There isn't really any room for dreamers. If you've got principles, that's nice. The market isn't interested in values, except for those it can define as price. all bow to the power of the market till it throws up a different face. If you're not white or male or compliant, the system is designed to keep you in your place. Not everything that counts can be counted. Who holds the markets to account? Not everything that counts can be counted. Not everything that can be counted counts.
My guest is Billy Bragg. We'll have more with Billy after a quick break. This is All of It on WNYC. This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. My guest is Billy Bragg. Billy has a new book out called The Three Dimensions of Freedom. I also want to talk to you about the compilation, the BBC compilation, a little bit. But you start your new book with the line, human beings have never had so much power.
Yeah, the smartphones in our pockets allow us to, you know, order up the most incredible things, both literally, physically, but also virtually, in terms of any particular truth that we want to hold. You can find evidence to back that up. And in that, veracity has kind of been completely devalued. You know, there's 16-year-old girls at the UN asking world leaders to get behind the science. I mean, you know, is this the enlightenment being overturned? What's happened? And I found, over the last few years, the new breed of, perhaps we might call them free speech warriors, who believe that they have an unalienable right to say what they want, when they want, to whomever they want, with no comeback, seem to have been setting the tone for debate. Now, that idea that you can say whatever you want with no comeback, that's not free speech, that's free reign. That's what they want. They don't want to be criticized. And criticized they should be, because they fail in their determination to speak and not be challenged. They fail to understand the second dimension of freedom, which is equality. That you should give equal weight and equal respect to the views of other people. That you should ensure that the right of free speech that you demand for yourself is respected when they're speaking to you. So that rather than having an argument, you can have deliberation. Of course you can disagree. Of course you can vehemently disagree. Of course you can offend other people. You know, that's part of it. But what you can't do is be abusive. What you can't do is attack people, make personal attacks on people, make racist, misogynist statements. And unfortunately, that aspect of liberty, shall we say, is not respected. And I would argue that without equality, liberty really is nothing more than privilege. You're getting to say that because you've got the loudest voice. But there's another aspect to freedom that I think is absolutely crucial if we are to live in a society where freedom has some agency, has some teeth, and that is accountability. Because liberty without accountability is the most dangerous freedom of all, and that is impunity. And far too often now, we're seeing people acting with impunity all the way to the highest office in the land, in your land and in my land. And I think that is dangerous, because the slippery slope to authoritarianism doesn't begin with jackboots in the streets and closing down newspapers. Mm-hmm. It begins when the regulations are so lax that the powerful feel that they can act without challenge. And that's both in the economy, both in society, and both in politics. And I would add also in relationships, I would say, because this book isn't only aimed at talking about the political discourse, the economy, the rise of algorithms. It's also about how we deal with one another in social media. How do we immediately come to a conclusion about the person that we're talking to, debating with, is acting in good faith? And I would suggest that the parameters of liberty, equality and accountability, is this person giving me the respect due? Mm-hmm. He doesn't know me, you know, never spoke to me before, and we're having a discourse. Are we respecting each other? Am I respecting their point of view? And am I accountable for something I've said? If I've said something and they challenge me, do I, you know, block them, throw up, you know, accuse them of political correctness mm-hmm. as a means of diverting the debate? Or do I accept that accountability is reciprocal? Yeah, that's the great thing about these three dimensions. The liberty is the most important mm-hmm. because it empowers us. It's the bedrock of freedom, the right to express your opinion. Equality is reciprocal. You know, it calls upon you as someone who respects freedom to reciprocate to others. Freedom isn't free. You know, I have to take some responsibility. But accountability is crucial because it is both empowering. It empowers you to hold others to account, but it's also reciprocal because you have to make yourself accountable to others. You have to respect their point of view.
I do like the accountability portion because I think people can say whatever they want. They can say all the racist, misogynist things they want, but then they can't put their finger in their dimple and say, yeah, but you can't.
Exactly.
How dare you?
I agree.
Come back at me.
Yeah, that's the thing. And you know, people have the right to say whatever they want, but they have to accept responsibility for that. You know, and I would argue responsibility and accountability are two slightly different things. Mm-hmm. You know, when you take responsibility, by using that term, we're suggesting it belongs to the individual. You're taking responsibility for yourself. But when someone holds you to account, that's someone outside of your personal space, and they're coming. So accountability suggests that you have some degree of agency over other people. And I do think at the root of both the rise of Donald Trump and Brexit is a lot of people out there feel they no longer have agency over their lives. They no longer feel their voice is heard. And an anger comes from that, and an urge to lash out towards minorities, towards, you know, people.
Other.
Anybody else. Yeah, exactly.
You write in the book, the 2008 crash was a crisis of accountability, not capitalism.
That's because the idea of neoliberal capitalism, the fundamental idea of that is firstly that the free market has all the answers to everybody's problems. And any politician that says that is shirking the responsibility as a legislator for regulating society. And the second thing that comes with that is the neoliberal concept of TINA, which was first coined by Margaret Thatcher. When asked about neoliberal capitalism, she said, there is no alternative. And we've lived with that. I mean, Tony Blair, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama even, I'm afraid, mm-hmm. we've lived through that. And one of the real things that I was deeply worried about during your last election was, although Hillary Clinton would have made a great president, she was not a change candidate. She was a candidate of the status quo, of more of the same. And I think that in many ways did for her more than Trump's tub thumping and sexism and racism. I think it was the idea that people desperately want change. They want change that affects their lives. And if they don't get it, don't be surprised if they're willing to vote for chaos, because that's what Brexit is and that's what Trump is. It's a finger to the people who live inside the Beltway, in your case, in my case, in Westminster, mm-hmm. who they feel have not listened to them. And, you know, Brexit really was a chance to give them a kick in the pants. And a lot of people who've never voted before queued up to do that. And we'll do it again if we have another referendum. We've got to be aware of that.
I'm interested. You mentioned earlier that you had something very specific in mind when you wrote your first book. Mm. There was something that really was a catalyst for you. Was there one thing outside of politics that was a catalyst for this book?
Well, I think it works on a number of different levels, really. You know that feeling when you buy a new car and nobody else has got one, and everywhere you go afterwards you keep seeing the same car, the same color? Well, I started to feel that about accountability. I started to see that as the hole in every donut I looked at, everywhere I saw a problem. And so I was looking for some way to join the dots into something that addressed this in a way that was straightforward, understandable. As a songwriter, you don't want to simplify things, but you want to give people a relatively accessible means by which to approach the subject and what you're trying to say. So I was invited to give a talk at the Bank of England, to the staff of the Bank of England, and I decided to talk about accountability because they've been responsible for the past few years, since the crash in 2008, for running a program of quantitative easing, which I don't know if you have that in America. It's where the central bank gives money to the retail banks to encourage them to lend to small businesses and home buyers. And what's happened is that the banks have just used it to shore up their bottom line, and that money has not got through to the real economy. And as a result, people with assets, houses, shares, they've benefited from it, but those people it was directed towards have not. And the problem is that the bank was given no direction. It was just told to give this money to the retail banks. And there should have been democratic control of that situation. If it wasn't working, it should have then gone to schools, to hospitals, to the social care sector.
There should have been accountability.
Well, so that's what I was talking about. So when our friends at Faber asked me if I was interested in writing and it is a pamphlet, it's not a huge book, it's only 17,000 words, it's a 90-minute read, I thought it would be interesting to kind of try to join the dots for people about how we got to this place, how the idea of a capitalist system that can run itself and doesn't need any regulations could come to be, but also how in history people have dealt with absolute power when they found it. You know, in my country, the last person to suspend Parliament was Charles I, and he suspended Parliament because he believed in absolute monarchy. And as a result of that, we ended up having a civil war. Now, we're not going to have a civil war, but we did, to resolve the issue of accountability, because he was defeated in battle, but he just wouldn't accept that Parliament had a role to play. So eventually they indulged, well, they didn't indulge, but they had a moment of rather extreme accountability when they chopped off his head. They put him on trial and chopped off his head. And what came from that is a transition in my country from policy that was made by tradition and theocracy to the beginnings of policy made by deliberation and democracy. It wasn't instant. We had to go through a lot more trouble. We nearly had another civil war in the 1680s that was resolved peaceably, the Glorious Revolution, our own Bill of Rights. Mm-hmm. But we ended up, because this was all before Thomas Paine wrote The Rights of Man, this was in 1688, we ended up our constitution, our Bill of Rights, being a agreement between the Crown and Parliament. We have no document in our constitution that begins "We the People." So and that's what was happening last week with the prorogation of Parliament and why the Queen was involved. Right. It all goes back to that, because the Prime Minister has...
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. I didn't know that part of it.
Yeah, the Prime Minister has what are called prerogative powers, which were powers that used to belong to the Crown, that now the Crown in Parliament he has. So he can declare war without asking Parliament. He can sign treaties without asking Parliament, and he can prorogue without asking Parliament. And Tony Blair did the Iraq War. He asked Parliament. And since then, I don't think any Prime Minister can now do that, to start a war without Parliament. He set a precedent there. And now Prime Minister can't prorogue Parliament without asking either. So slowly, we're getting around to a more written constitution. But it all comes back from that moment of... It's in Magna Carta, actually. And it's really strange. You know, Magna Carta was signed in 1215 by King John.
We like that over here.
You do. I know.
We like the Magna Carta over here.
You know what was in that? You know what was in Magna Carta? Something somebody said this week. No one is above the law. You know, when Nancy Pelosi said that, I happened to be buying a coffee when I saw that in somewhere. And when she said, you know, the president, you know, must be impeached, no one is above the law, that was the voice of the barons in the meadow at Runnymede trying to deal with the absolute power of monarchy. Now we have the absolute power of the presidency, the absolute power of the free market. Through our entire history of your country, my country, and every country, the great struggle has been to decide who gets to write the rules, and most importantly, who gets to break them. And that really is, that's what Magna Carta was about. That's what I would argue. Your revolution and your civil war and our civil war. Those moments come where nations have to decide if anyone is ever so mighty. that they are above the law. Now, some people think they are. I can think of two people, actually, off the top of my head, who are both in executive positions who think that. And it's a challenge. It's a challenge to your constitution. It's a challenge to our constitution. Do we live in a democracy? Because people think democracy and accountability are synonymous. They're not. They're more, their relationship is a bit more like a Venn diagram.
Mm-hmm.
And when there's a lot of consensus, then there's a great deal of overlap. But there are times, such as now, when bad faith players push democracy one way and accountability the other way. So you have the kind of like theatre of democracy, but you don't have the teeth
of
accountability.
Of it.
And this week, Nancy Pelosi and Justice Lady Hale have both stood up and said, "Thus far and no more." And I'm very much encouraged by that. I'm someone who, as a progressive, I believe the glass is always half full. That's my duty as someone who's progressive. Well, I believe in humanity. And so I feel this week I'm encouraged. I feel encouraged this week.
I'm curious if you have a whole fan base that loves your music and has for years. Do you use this writing? Do you use your platform as an artist to sort of as to entice your music fans into your writing and into thinking about these things more than just your music?
Bottom line, Alex, I'm a communicator. Whether I'm writing a song, doing a gig, writing a book, talking to your audience, firing something off on Twitter, I'm a communicator. When I was 19 years old, if I wanted someone in New York to hear my opinion, I had only one option available to me, which was to learn to play guitar, write songs, do gigs, and hope one day that I would come and play on the roof of the Danceteria for 5 nights in August 1984. And lo and behold, I was fortunate enough to do that. And I am even more fortunate to still be able to play in your city. So that's, you know, that was a medium for me to communicate. And I'm still trying to offer people my own perspective. At the shows at the Bowery this week, I'll be hoping to send the audience away with a different perspective on politics, on love, on how to play the guitar, and whether it's worth singing in tune. I hope they'll go away and think, well, that was interesting. You know, that's my hope, that it's not just escapism, I fire them up a bit, because I tell you this, they fire me up, the way they respond to my songs.
I want to ask you about one more thing before I get a song from you, another song. Best of Billy Bragg at the BBC 1983 to 2019, a new compilation?
Yes, a new compilation album, yeah, of sessions that I did back in the day for people like John Peel at night, Janice Long, Kid Jensen. They were from the time when everyone was listening to the BBC, everyone was listening to John Peel. So if you got a session on John Peel, all of a sudden everybody knew you were, and you could get gigs anywhere around the country. Before, I was getting gigs on a word of mouth basis, and so consequently, you know, it was just around London. But once I'd been on Peel, everybody knew who I was. And there's a lovely story about how I got my first Peel. I don't know if you know it.
No, please tell me.
When my first album, Life's a Riot with Spy vs. Spy, came out, you know, they gave me a box of 25 records and said, see if we can get some radio play. There was no one to plug them or anything. So I took some copies down to the BBC Broadcasting House, and in envelopes, wrote John Peel's name, left for John Peel and the other DJs. And that night, we were in with some mates in Hyde Park, which is about a mile from the BBC, playing football. And we'd finished, and we were having a few beers, and someone had their car door open. We were listening to Kid Jensen on the radio, which is the guy who was on before Peel. Peel was on at 10 o'clock, Kid was on at 8. Anyway, John Peel came in to talk about the show, who was on while we were standing. And he said, I would do anything for a mushroom biryani, which is an Indian meal with rice. And so I thought, wow, here's my chance. So I got out my football kit. I nipped down the back of Oxford Street, where there's lots of Indian restaurants, got a mushroom biryani, went to BBC to the reception, and there was a, you know, guy in a uniform, peak cap at reception. I said, oh, mushroom biryani for John Peel. Blow me, they phoned him up and said to him, John, your mushroom biryani's it. And he come down. He came down to take it from my hand. So I was able to say to him, hi, John, my name's Billy Bragg. I left an album for you today. I wonder if you'd perhaps give it a listen. He was like, yeah, sure. So I went home and I tuned in, and he played track one, side one, and afterwards he said, and I would have played it without the mushroom biryani. So that was the beginning of a wonderful relationship.
That's one of those stories that, had you been 10 feet away and not heard that,
It's weird, isn't it?
Have you been 5 minutes late?
Exactly, exactly. Well, on you know, on such things, my career has turned. So I feel very, very privileged to have met John. He was a lovely, lovely guy. And, you know, the BBC have always been good at sort of giving a platform to new talent, and they continue to do that. But they also let a few of us old guys on as well. So there's some stuff from even from this year. In fact, I was live on air when England won the Cricket World Cup, playing a song called The Space Race Is Over, when the guys in the room who were watching it silently...
You could see them so gesturing.
Well, they went mad. And the guys in there went mad. And if you in the studio office, and so if you listen to Space Race Is Over, I think I sing the second half of one of the verses twice. But that's why it's not very often England win the Cricket World Cup. So I can only tell you it's live music. That's what it is.
It's the best.
Yeah.
Let's listen to a track from your new release, which was just put out this month. It's called The Best of Billy Bragg at the BBC 1983 to 2019. That was A New England from the John Peel Session, July 27th, 1983. Would you play one more song for us?
I would, yes. I would happily do that. I want to play a song about... I jokingly refer to this as a song about the crisis in masculinity. And it kind of is. It's also about... Some of your listeners really should know that even as a progressive, and even as someone who writes books about accountability, most of my songs are love songs. That's all right. You know, Smokey Robinson is still my main man. It's not all the Clash. So this is just a song about the fact that there are different ways to be masculine. There's not only one way to be masculine. It's called Handyman Blues. Never gonna be the handyman around the house my father was, so don't be asking me to hang a curtain rail for you, because that screwdriver business just gets me confused. It takes me half an hour to change a fuse. When I flick the switch, the light's all blue. I'm not your handyman. Don't be expecting me to put up shelves or build a garden shed. But I can write a song that tells the world how much I love you instead. Now I'm not any good at pottery, so let's lose a T and just shift back the E, and I'll find a way to make my poetry build a roof over our head. You see what I did there? You see what I did there? That's clever, yeah. I know it looks like I'm just sat here reading the paper, but these ideas I'll turn to gold dust later. 'Cause I'm a writer, not a decorator. I'm not your handyman, yeah. 'Cause I'm a writer and an agitator. I'm not your handyman.
Billy Bragg, thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Alison.
This is All of It on WNYC.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.